suggesting, Mr. President, there's a military plot to take over the government. This may occur sometime this coming Sunday.
There are some who will say, it can never happen here. But this is the story of how it could happen. In 7 days of intrigue, of blackmail, of terror, an eternity of suspense. This is the astounding story of a military plot to overthrow the government of the United States, which, if successful, would change the fate of every American.
You're a nightcrawler, Colonel. A peddler. You sell information. Are you sufficiently up on your Bible to know who Judas was?
Yes, I know who Judas was. He was a man I worked for and admired until he disgraced the 4 stars on his uniform.
7 days in May, the first day when a Marine colonel wondered who was inciting screaming mobs in Madison Square Garden.
We want Trump! We want Trump! We want Trump!
The second day that uncovered secret meetings in Washington's back alleys. The third day when unknown men prepared to kidnap the president from his private vacation resort. The fourth day that brought a secret presidential messenger to death in a plane crash in Spain. The day a senator of the United States was held against his will. The fifth day when a woman found her past being used for blackmail.
Look, Ellie, if I could tell you why I had to do this,
I'll tell you something.
You don't understand.
I was a stupid, impressionable female who let an Air Force general use her like his personal airplane.
The sixth day. The discovery of a desert base for an airborne task force, kept secret even from the President of the United States. The seventh day, when the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff dared the President of the United States to stop the conspiracy that couldn't be proved.
You're not a weak sister, Mr. President. You're a criminally weak sister.
You say I've duped the people, General. I built them, I've misled them, I've stripped them naked and made them defenseless. You accuse me of having lost their faith, deliberately and criminally shut my ears to the national voice.
I do.
Well, where the hell have you heard that voice, General? In freight elevators? In dark alleys? In secret places in the dead of night? How did that voice seep into a locked room full of conspirators? That's not where you hear the voice of the people, General, not in this republic.
And I will not resign voluntarily.
I'm going to fight you.
And then we'll see which one of us the United States is willing to follow.
In May is from 1964 and is directed by John Frankenheimer, based on the hit novel and adapted by Rod Serling. President Jordan Lyman, played by Frederick March, is at an all-time low in terms of public approval. He is in the middle of a tense peace treaty negotiation with the Soviet Union, and the hawks in the government, led by war hero James Mattoon Scott, Burt Lancaster, accused the president of being dangerously inept and naive. His right-hand man is Colonel Martin Jiggs Casey, Kirk Douglas, who seems a little less critical of the political side of this debate. When pressed for his opinion on the treaty at a party, attended by, among others, Scott's jilted mistress Eleanor Holbrook, played by Ava Gardner, he demurs. Casey's neutrality is tested when he notices some strange behavior by some of his fellow high-level servicemen. After some gentle poking around, Casey's curiousness turns to fear as he starts to think that there is a plot afoot to kidnap the president that very weekend and force a military takeover. So this is one of my favorite movies, and this episode is a little different in that I did not take a guest's suggestion of a movie to cover. This was my idea, and I didn't know anybody who has seen this movie, so I reached out, and Ryan was nice enough to say he was willing to do it. So Ryan has never seen it before. I sent Ryan the DVD, so I'm about to find out on the air, like the rest of you, what Ryan thought of this movie. So here we go. Ryan, don't let your answer, you know, be colored by the fact that, you know, you may have other guest appearances lined up or maybe not. So what did you think of 7 Days in May?
Well, now after that, I kind of want to say, boy, this was a waste of my time. This was an awful movie. I hated this. Oh, man. Never send me one of these movies for free again. So I had heard of the movie vaguely. Like, I'd heard the name, I think, but really knew nothing of the plot, knew nothing of the story, clearly had never seen it. So when I shot it, I was like, okay, I kind of know you told me the bare bones basics of the plot, much less than what you just summarized there. So I turned it, put it on without really knowing anything or having any kind of expectations.
That's great. That's a great way to go into a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Almost completely blind, which I can't think of the last time that has ever happened for me. I thought it was a little bit slow going, but once I got it, I was like, okay, this feels a little bit timely, even though, you know, it's a, you know, 40, 50-year-old movie. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. I really, really liked this movie. I caught up on a lot of the themes, and I saw parallels of things that we could discuss in a contemporary context, which freaked me the hell out. But I thought it was terrific. I thought the performances by everybody involved were great. And as soon as I saw, like, I was like, oh, script by Rod Serling? I was like, really? I was like, okay, yeah. where are we going with this? I was like, is this going to be a Twilight Zone type of thing? And clearly not, but it was still, yeah, I was really enjoying this one. Thank you for getting me involved with this one.
I'm thrilled to hear it. Yeah, this was one of those movies that I think I've mentioned this on the show before. Well, I know I have about that. I worked at a movie video store for many years, and I sort of sent myself to unofficial film school during those years because the rentals were free, and you know I was like living at home and I had nothing else to do, so I was like, well, I'll just watch three or four movies a night. And this was one of those movies that I, you know, like you, I didn't know anything about, but I was like, this is an amazing cast. Rod Serling, you know, I mean, wow, this is a great, you know, and I like movies about like government conspiracies and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's fun. And I watched it and man, like you, I just got sucked into it immediately. And a lot of it has to do with the performances. Burt Lancaster, Burt Lancaster really sinks his teeth into the role of General Matoon Scott. He's clearly playing like a Curtis LeMay.
Yeah, type. Yeah.
And you know, Burt Lancaster was in his real life a ultra liberal. He was a super, super duper liberal, and yet here he is playing the most right wing of right wing guys. And I love the way, I mean, he did this in all his movies. He kind of had that clipped way of speaking. That's a terrible Burt Lancaster, but
sure.
He, when he speaks as General Scott, he really has this tone of utter superiority,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's almost like a whisper the way he talks. And he's just like, you know, frankly, Mr. President, you're not qualified. You know,
yeah.
he's so. So self-righteous, and he so believes that he is smarter and more American and more patriotic than everyone else, and he's just delusional. I mean, he's just utterly delusional, and I really feel like Lancaster just sank his teeth into this part. I think he's tremendous in it. Kirk Douglas is ostensibly the hero of the film because he's just said he is Matoon Scott, General Scott's right-hand man, but he's just not as extreme. He just isn't, and you see that pretty early on that he – you know, he respects General Scott, and they make pains to mention that Scott is a genuine war hero. You know, mm-hmm. he's not a chicken hawk. He's not one of these keyboard warriors. He's a genuine war hero, but he has gone so far over the edge that, you know, he really believes that he has every right to try and take over the government. And we do find out, of course, that it all starts with this whole idea of the Preakness. The Preakness is running on the weekend, which it never does, but this is a special Preakness because this movie takes place in a near future, which is undetermined because
right.
in this film, there is technology that does not exist. I mean, there's video phones, there's video conferencing in this movie.
That was great. I love
that. The scene with Burt Lancaster and Frederick March that they're basically doing telecommuting. And I'm like, oh, that doesn't exist. So this movie exists in some sort of weird 1965 of the future kind of thing. But, the whole thing is this thing with the Preakness. The Preakness is running, and one of the guys who's in on the conspiracy, we don't know it at the time, tells Jiggs Casey, hey, we all got to make sure we get our bets in on time, especially Sunday, know what I mean? And mm-hmm. Casey's like, what does that even mean? And so he starts looking into it, and then he confides in the president, played by Frederick March. Frederick March has always been one of my favorite actors. I've loved him ever since I first saw him in, I think, Inherit the Wind. And he's kind of forgotten nowadays. He just doesn't, you know, he's not like Spencer Tracy or Henry Fonda. People still kind of remember that. Frederick March, even though he won 2 Best Actor Oscars, he's kind of forgotten, but he plays Jordan Lyman. He is the kind of president that I would want. The sort of thoughtful, you know, smart guy.
Yeah, he's sort of, and you said he's sort of forgotten. Like, he was the one of these guys that I've known the least about, that I've seen the least, and I think, but I was, every time he was on, I was like, I really like this guy. I thought he'd outshone Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster. And I mean, we will get to it eventually, but yeah, his showdown in the Oval Office with Lancaster is terrific. And that was the other thing, just again, not knowing going into this, but, you know, seeing Kurt Lancaster, who's billed first, just assuming he's going to be the star, he's going to be our hero, and then kind of finding out, I was like, wait a minute, no, he's the antagonist. And and the way, you know, Jiggs Casey, this character, we do find out that, yeah, he disagrees with the president's opinion. He is sort of like this descendant. He's like, yeah, I think this treaty that the president is setting up between the Soviets is misguided, and it could very well end up biting us in the ass. It might turn into a real problem. But I'm not going to undercut the entire democratic process by throwing my lot in with a coup d'etat.
Yeah.
He's like, that's wrong. So he is kind of in this weird sort of curiously position where he ultimately is the real hero and the real patriot, even though his part is sort of in the climax of the movie is kind of minimal, but he is sort of the spirit of the movie. In that he represents, I disagree with you, but I'm not going to destroy the system in order to get my way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was going to say that's in part, I think, what resonates today with some of the conversations we could be having,
mm-hmm.
and also just sort of it's what makes him the true patriot and the true hero of the piece.
Yeah, there's the scene at the party where mm-hmm. he sort of kind of gets pigeonholed or buttonholed, whatever the phrase is, by some of Scott's, you know, supporters. And he's like, you know, they're like, well, do you support the treaty or not? And he's kind of like, it's irrelevant whether I support the treaty. The treaty is going to be passed and it is my job to abide by it. You know, mm-hmm. he's like, it doesn't really matter. And they kind of like, they even accuse him of, they say, you know, what are those medals on your chest for? Basically, I forget what they say, something like, you know, hedging your bets. And he's like, mm-hmm. and then he goes in, you know, he kind of like goes with a joke and he goes, no, it's for cocktail diplomacy. you know, and he just says, look, I may, like you just said, he's like, I may not agree with this treaty. And in fact, I don't, but it is not my job to then buck the system. I have to, you know, this is the law of the land. And so this is what I'm going to follow. And, you know, and they make pains to show that, you know, I mean, the president, played by, you know, again, Frederick March, is pretty unabashedly a hero in this movie. I mean, they present him as forthright, honest, far-reaching. He has a speech about how the nuclear age has turned people into, like, sort of feeling that they're not in control of their own destinies anymore, and that causes mm-hmm. a sickness and a schism in the American psyche. But they make pains to show that the people around him, his handlers, and that is played by a murderer's row of great character actors. This movie mm-hmm. has Martin Balsam in it. To me, if a movie has Martin Balsam in it, it can't be all bad, because Martin
I love him so much.
Always good. But he, one of his handlers is this guy played a guy named Christopher Todd, played by George McCready, who was in Paths of Glory with Kirk Douglas, and
uh-huh.
he is sleazy to an nth degree. Even though he's on Jordan Lyman's side, he is very sleazy, and he's kind of like almost like a Terry McAuliffe type. Like, he's, you know, he's kind of on the kind of quote unquote good guy side, but he's so unctuous that you feel very nervous about him. And there's this whole angle that General Scott has had this affair with Eleanor Holbrook, played by Ava Gardner, who, frankly, a little too old for that part, but okay, we'll put that aside. And he's like,
that's actually not my complaint about her part in the movie. My complaint about her is probably her part is the one part of this movie that you could just lift completely from the plot and it changes the least. It's sort of like they were like, we, you know, there are women in this world, we should probably have one of them in
right.
the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically her, we'll get to that, her whole plot thing is really for like a character reveal. But there's this whole scene where Christopher Todd basically says, you know, if we have to take General Scott down by exposing his affair, that's what we'll do. And Lyman and Casey are kind of like, that's not the way to do that. You know, no, we should bring him down because his ideas are wrong, not right. because he had an affair. And there's even this whole scene where they argue back and forth, and Christopher Todd calls General Scott a jackal. And Casey really objects to that. And he's like, you know, he's wearing half the medals that are owed him. You can call him many things, but he's not a jackal. And so, right. you know, I love that sort of even – I mean, this movie is clearly on the side of the government, of the presidency. But at the same time, it is showing that some of the people around the presidency are willing to bend the rules to get their way, which in their own way is kind of just as bad as what Scott wants to do. Now,
but the president doesn't, and you said
– The president doesn't. Luckily, they –
like, you know. He has that moment where he's cornered and he takes the letters that could expose
Scott.
Scott, thank you. That could expose Scott and, like, you basically blackmail him into, like, ending this whole attempt. And he has them in his hand, and then he just shoves them back in the drawer and never even lets Scott know that he has that, you know, bullet in his chamber. And yeah. and they even have that line at the end when she says, you know, were those the bullets meant to kill him? And Casey basically says they could have been, but they weren't.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's really what Ava Gardner is served for, is to give Jordan Lyman that character beat, that he had that in his ability to mm-hmm. destroy Scott using sort of sleazy tactics, but he chose not to do it, even at the risk of bringing down the government.
Right.
He didn't do it. And so that's why Ava Gardner is there. I feel like – I mean, Ava Gardner at this point was like in her 40s, and I think she was just a little too old to be playing the jilted girlfriend kind of thing. There's a great – it's so funny how, you know, you can sense how different things have changed, because there's a scene where Kirk Douglas like really treats Eleanor Holbrook really horribly, and he slaps her – or she slaps him. And it's like you really wouldn't be able to get away with that nowadays. It's like, you know, he says you're not the first girl to end up at the bottom of the deck, which is such a dismissive phrase.
Right. But at the end, he asks her for a date, and it's all good.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They're all good. Well. I mean, she needs to get out more, clearly, because she's just sort of moving around these guys. By the way, this was Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster. They did 7 films together. This was, I think, their 5th. And they apparently were not particularly great friends in real life. They're both, I think politically, they were both pretty evenly matched. But they weren't great friends, but they had a great chemistry together. And they recognized that, which is why they kept doing these movies over and over again. And they do – their scenes together have a real crackle, because it's like you know that Casey really looks up to Scott, but Scott keeps Casey at a certain distance. And it's interesting that, you know, when all this plotting is going on, Casey's never involved.
Mm-hmm.
He never involves Casey because Scott knows that Casey won't go along with it.
Yeah. Yeah. He keeps him at that. And that's one of the things that Casey recognizes, which sort of tips him off, is all these things moving around and he's not in the know, that he's being kept out. And when one of his, you know, there are these sort of like lines dropped around him, and the guy's like, yeah, well, you must know that my new assignment is part of this EcomCon. And Casey's like, I've never heard of that. Why have I never heard of that? And that sort of like leads him into I think the movie kind of hinges on 2 great scenes that I particularly loved. And it's when Casey tells the president and his aide, Paul Gerard, played by, as you mentioned, Martin Balsam, who as soon as I saw him, I was like, Arbogast!
Yeah,
Arbogast from Psycho.
Yeah.
I was like, is he going to die in this one? And I was like, oh, but I think the scene where he tells them and basically lays out all of these clues, all of these things, and kind of like puts it in front of you, he's like, I think there's going to be a military attempt to take over the government. And then later on, the next scene that I think does it is in the White House when we see Scott and Lyman go head to head.
Yeah.
But yeah, just the first scene when Casey's like laying it out before and they're like, speak plainly, you know, like I'm giving you an order, just tell me what's on your mind. It's like, nah, you're asking this guy to confess or to confide in you like something that he doesn't want to admit in his own mind. This isn't an easy thing for him to say. And
yeah,
but the way he lays it out, I thought it was terrific, and it was engrossing. And at that point in the movie, I was really thoroughly hooked in. I was like, this is a good conspiracy movie. I was like, I'm digging this.
I love the way Casey sort of dances around it, because he did, like you just said, he doesn't want to say it, and then the president just goes, get to the point, Colonel Casey. Like, he's just like, I don't have enough time for this. What's going on? And there's this whole thing about that it's there's going to be this test, and that is going to involve the president being in this underground bunker. There won't be any reporters. So it's like it's all lining up to be able to have the president spirited away, away from the press. And, you know, it's that whole setup of like, oh, okay, all these things that would normally be taking place without any worries, when you start looking at them from a different angle, they take an ominous cast because you're like, mm-hmm. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, this guy is going to, you know, and there's a before the scene that you mentioned with between Lyman and Scott, which we'll get to because it is my favorite scene of the movie. They have another confrontation over their video phone.
Yeah.
And Scott is still trying to kind of bullshit. Lyman, and he's like, "Hello, Mr. President," he's like, "You know, are you going to come and do the test?" And he's like, "No, I'm not. I've canceled the test." And he's like, "Well, why is that?" "I'm tired, General. I'm going to go to my my vacation home and fish." And he's like, "Well, Mr. President, I don't think it's a good idea." And he's like, "You let me worry about that." And then he finally ends it with, "I hope you catch some fish, Mr. President." And then Lyman just goes, "Goodbye, General Scott." He's like, "I don't like you. I'm not going to pretend anymore. I don't like you. All right? That's the end of this."
Yeah. The dialogue is really strong in, like, all their scenes. But I think more than that, it's just the way the actors are just able to convey just, like, "Yeah, I don't like you, and I'm not even going to pretend," like, in moments like that where it's just, like, there's a sort of forced civility in a lot of these sequences, especially when you have some of the military guys, like when Gerard goes to see the admiral, and he's just like, "Look, just sign the damn thing. I don't have time. I'm not playing around with this anymore."
One of the guys involved in the conspiracy is an admiral played by John Houseman, the great John Houseman, who worked with Orson Welles and was really not, I don't want to say much of an actor, as in not a good actor, but he didn't act a lot. He really worked behind the scenes, and apparently he did his part for a bottle of wine. That was his fee from John Frankenheimer. And he is really the guy that begins the crumble of this conspiracy, because they have him dead to rights. And, you know, he's the one who basically admits, "All right, yeah, this is what's going on." And it really, that's where it all starts to fall apart, because what happens is once the president gets wind of this conspiracy, he sends out his agents to go investigate. They're supposedly, you mentioned this thing called a ComCon, which is this base that's been built with government money in the middle of nowhere. And there's this whole conversation about, there's a guy who's like, "What? You know, I don't understand why we have this base." And he says, I don't get it. I can't get answers." And he says, "It seems like my boys are being trained for defense instead of," I forget what the phrase is, but he's like,
"No, they were like doing maneuvers for security of like high level, like communication systems." But he says something like, he's like, "You know what? It's the damnedest thing is we're spending a lot more time practicing seizing the location than defending it."
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that tips him off. It's like, oh, this is clearly an operation to hijack the telecommunication sites around the world, around the United States. Yeah.
And there's a wonderfully creepy scene where this general, played by, I forget his name. It's not Richard Anderson. Richard Anderson is a movie from the $6 Million Man. But they get this general out, another assistant of the president, Senator Raymond Clark, played by the great Edmund O'Brien. He goes and he gets this general and gets him out of there, and he's going to fly him back to Washington. They go to this airport. Mm-hmm. And it's a regular airport. It's not a military airport. It's a commercial airport. And he tells the general, "Wait here. I have to make a phone call." He has to go into a phone booth, of course. That's really why you couldn't do that movie today. He goes into a phone booth, makes the call, and basically says, "I've got the general. I'm on my way back." He comes out, and the general, gone.
Yeah, just missing, and gone. Nobody knows where.
And nobody saw him, and there's no tip-off. There's nothing. Yeah. You never see anybody. That, to me, is one of the creepier scenes, because it's done in plain sight.
Right.
And somehow, a bunch of goons came by and took a guy in a uniform away, and nobody noticed it. And there's no music in the scene. It's just, you just hear the ambient noise of the crowd. That scene is really, really creepy, because it's just like, whoa, wait a minute. What happened to that guy? Like, what'd they do with him?
Yeah, no, yeah, it is incredible. And it is kind of haunting. It's like, okay, I'm assuming he was arrested today. Are they going to mention this? Are they going to explain what happened? Like, yeah, and it's, that part was unnerving, with just like, okay, this can't go well because they're just spending our time looking at the senator like with his back to us. We're just looking at his back. I was like, something's going on behind him. What are we gonna? And turn around, just like, oh, just gone, just yeah. Vanished in the wind. And he's running around asking. He's like, did you see a big tall guy in a uniform? And be like, no. It's like, how do you know? What did you not see?
Yeah, he even asked some nuns at some point. Yeah, like, nuns go by, and he's like, you didn't? No. Yeah, I mean, if I had been that guy, I mean, of course, nowadays I'd have my cell phone. That guy would be pinned to my sleeve. I'd be like, you're not going anywhere. Let me just make my call. I'm gonna be staring at you while I make this call because you are very valuable. Yeah, this thing is really littered with just great character actors from beginning to end. And the big scene, really, is the confrontation between General Scott and President Lyman, where Lyman gets Scott. He tells him, you know, bring Scott to my office. And they have this absolutely amazing scene. You heard a bit of it in the trailer, which opened mm-hmm. the episode, where they have this debate. They have just an intellectual debate about government. And, you know, Scott is so gone that he just says, you know, don't tell me that I couldn't be president. I could walk out there right now and be elected president and be sitting behind that desk by tomorrow. And the president is just disgusted at that level. He says, you know, I don't know whether to laugh at that kind of megalomania or simply cry. And I love the whole idea, and this, you know, whatever about the real life, but this whole idea of, you know, you say you love the democratic idea so much, then he says, then run for office. You know, mm-hmm. if you're so hell-bent on protecting the tools that the democracy gives you, why don't you use them? You know, and there's the whole bit about, you know, where have you heard the voice of the people, General? In locked elevators, in freight elevators, in the dark of mm-hmm. night? That mm-hmm. scene is – and the two of them just – you don't need a whole lot when you have two great actors just sitting in chairs, right, just squaring off against each other.
But I also think – I mean, what the movie does so beautifully is, you know, the president makes that point. He's like, hey, if you really think you're righteous and you're correct and I'm wrong, beat me in an election. Yep. He says, there's an election in like a year and a half or something, or like
months,
2 years. Yeah, 18
like
months
that,
or something. Come back. You can be sitting in this office and you can make that decision. It's like, why are you like setting up this coup, going behind my back, doing all these shady, illegal things? And to its credit, Scott looks back at him and says, I don't think there will be an electorate in a year and a half. He's like, if I don't do this now, you have taken us to the path of destruction. He truly believes the Soviets are going to nuke us in this moment of weakness. And he's like, if I don't do this, so he does believe in his cause. He does believe that this is his only way, that maybe he could be elected. Maybe he could actually win in the system, but there's not enough time. He thinks the system is failing him. So I like that he kind of, he makes that point. It gives him that chance of expressing himself. I also love what Frankenheimer does in that scene. Is he takes the president away from his desk. He basically
right, yeah.
sitting in chairs. They're in the Oval Office, but Lyman is not. He's rarely in a position of strength. And actually, we see him, they like when he's making these like well thought out, like educated, like points about democracy and about civility and being, you know, giving us, you know, that moral high ground. It's usually a good close up shot of him, but a lot of the other times it's a wide shot and you see him looking very small.
And he's much older than Lancaster.
He is. And there are times when Lancaster stands up and seems to be towering above him when it looks like he's in this position of strength. And at the end of the scene, after Lancaster walks out, the president kind of like steps out into the hall and he's flanked by just like the pillars of the sort of the foyer and the White House, that office, that space looks so much bigger than him. And you see, because he lost. Yeah, he could have blackmailed him. He could have taken out those letters, but he didn't. And he's just in this moment where I know what this guy is doing and I have no power to stop him, really. And I just thought, like, in terms of direction, it really kind of sold that moment. I thought that was one of Frankenheimer's, like, best jobs in the movie, of just getting the mood in those scenes.
Yeah, it's beautifully staged by Frankenheimer. I mean, John Frankenheimer kind of knew what he was doing. His previous film before this was The Manchurian Candidate.
Right.
So, I mean, he clearly had a command of political thrillers. You know, I mean, to do this film back-to-back mm-hmm. is pretty remarkable. And the film he did before that was The Birdman of Alcatraz
for
Lancaster. So, I mean, my God, he was on a real roll at this point. And that shot that we mentioned of the paperwork, it's mm-hmm. wonderfully framed because the camera pans back and we see Lyman hunched over. We're behind right. him, and we just see his hand on that paperwork. And Scott is way off in the background, and he says something like, "Is there anything else, Mr. President?" And there's just that pause where he's got his hands on that, and his hands are almost shaking. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, "No," and he puts the thing. And so it's beautifully again. You know, you don't need to have giant blue beams that are going to destroy the planet for drama. You know, you can really just have some guy. This whole movie, except for a couple of brief action sequences, there's the scene with the Jeep where they storm the
right.
The guy. You know, they take over. I'm countermanding those orders. Yeah, and you know,
right.
other than a couple of brief action moments, this movie is really just people in rooms talking to one another. I mean, the whole movie is just that, and yet, to me, it is incredibly tense, and for many times as I've seen it, and part of that has got to be, of course, Rod Serling.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy knew how to write.
Yeah, he did.
Sakes. And this movie, you know, other than, as I mentioned, the future elements with the video phones, and this movie does not have any sci-fi element to it. It's mm-hmm. just a straightforward drama.
And the way tension is built and suspicion where you're like, wait a minute, like, where is this conspiracy going? Like, when Balsam, Arbogast, when he actually, he gets the signed documents from the Admiral. He's like, I can prove this conspiracy. I've got a smoking gun. He puts it in his cigarette case, gets on a plane. The next thing we find out is the plane crashed.
Yep.
It's like, holy, oh my God. It's like, what? I was like, did they take it down? Did the Admiral sabotage the plane? Did they murder this guy? Or was it just a fluke? Like, what's going on? And, like, was that their only chance? Did their evidence literally just, like, go up in a plane explosion or something in the mountains over Spain? And they end up bringing it back, and it still ends up being the key that brings them down eventually. So it wasn't – he didn't die in vain, but it was still kind of like this – wait, whoa, what is the implication of this?
Yeah, this is super heavy all of a sudden.
Yeah, and I think that moment kind of makes it a little bit more real, because, like, even though, like, we're not going to end up seeing, you know, the military taking over, there's not a junta in this thing, but just, okay, we do have stakes, we do have a death in this movie, somebody is killed investigating this, and... yeah, it drives a sense of fear and paranoia at just the perfect point.
Yeah, and it's at the end of the film where we find out that, you know, Lyman gets the paperwork that proves the conspiracy, and there's this wonderful line which is very sad where he says, you know, basically he tells Scott, you have to resign because if we reveal to the world what just almost happened here, it would be a disaster for this country. And which is a great moment. I mean, a wonderful character moment for Lyman, because if Lyman really wanted to tear Scott a new one and just destroy him in the eyes of the public, you could do no better than to show the paperwork that says, hey, this guy just tried to take over the government by force, but he's not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
He's not. He's going to let Scott sort of just retire. And of course, Scott won't do it. He's like, I will not resign. And it's his fellow conspirators, once they are pegged by the president as being – he basically says, I'm asking for the resignation of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the so-and-so, and the rest of them all fall away, and it's Scott who remains steadfast. And it's when he finds out that the rest of – he finds out over television. You hear it as an audio clip. This movie has great audio, particularly.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, really, like, there are smash cuts of where audio cuts out very abruptly. It's very discordant and very – sort of unsettling, so it's really perfect. Whoever did the sound mixing or the sound editing did a tremendous job. That's why they give those Oscars away on the telecast, I guess, because they're really well done. But when General Scott finds out that basically his whole plan has collapsed from underneath him, and he gets into his private car, and there's just this wonderful moment where he gets in the back of the car and his driver says, "Where to, sir?" And there's this very long pause, and then the driver says again, like something like, "Sir?" And Scott just says, "Take me home."
Home.
And originally, there was an original ending where Scott was supposed to die in a car accident at that point. I'm glad they cut that. That would not have been necessary.
Yeah, I looked at it, and I think that was how the book ended. Or not Scott, but one of the other conspirators, the other senator who was in on the conspiracy, ended up like dying in a car crash that might have been suicide, might have been accidental. But yeah, I think they wrote that ending and they were like, no, that's not. And I agree. I'm glad they didn't end it that way, because it would have felt unearned, kind of like beneath the dignity of the character.
Yeah, yeah,
And just sort of like overly, sort of like falsely melodramatic for what the movie had been up to that point.
Yeah, you don't need it. I mean, in fact, that's what I kind of like about it's just kind of a reductive way of putting it, but you know, the villain has been defeated, and you don't need to dig him. You don't need to push him into the dirt. He's just going to go home and sit in his house and live out his days in frustration. And he's very, I mean, I'm sure I mentioned that he's probably certainly based on Curtis LeMay. There's another general named Edwin Walker who had a very similar career and actively, like, while during Eisenhower's reign and during Kennedy's reign, like, actively said things about, you know, well, we need to take these people out by force, then we have to. I mean, he was just utterly disgraced. And he eventually was forced out of the military. And he didn't go and die in some spectacular flame out. He lived until 1993, and he just died in his home, kind of a bitter old man. And that's what you get – that's the sense you get from General Scott. He's just – he's utterly demoralized. He knows he's lost, and he's just going to go home and shut his drapes, and we'll never hear from him again. And I like that. It's a quiet ending. I like that the movie is willing to do that. It's willing to just make it have it end on that sort of quiet denouement as opposed to something big and dramatic.
Yeah. I mean, the literal technical end of the film is very sort of abrupt because it ends with the end of the president's speech. And then it just almost sort of like hard cuts to the ending title card, the end. I was waiting for the moment to resonate a little bit more to give us a little bit more of a sort of drawn out. But it's fairly like, yeah, he gives his speech and we end just chop there. And
yeah.
But it landed. So it was definitely like it felt a little bit abrupt just because it was not what I was expecting. It felt a little bit like we wouldn't get that type of ending today, but it certainly worked for the film. So, yeah.
Yeah, this movie. Yeah, the opening credits are done by the great Saul Bass, the wonderful genius Saul Bass, and so they have that kind of very dun dun dun, you know, kind of thing. And that's, I think that's what helps keep this film feels kind of to me fresh and modern, is it has that very abrupt kind of feel to it, and I really like that. I said it. The final speech by Jordan Lyman is. It sort of sums up the themes of it, of the idea of, you know, you're looking to do something. You're looking to the future. You're not just constantly locked in this idea of, you know, we're going to be constantly fighting. No, we can look out and go. And, of course, the movie doesn't give you a cop-out. I mean, the movie, as I said, is clearly on Jordan Lyman's side. But it doesn't necessarily say that he's right. We don't know that the treaty is going to work.
True.
I mean, General Scott has a fairly persuasive argument where he says no piece of paper has ever stopped, you know, an aggressive country from waging war. And, you know, you'd be hard pressed to argue with that, really. I mean, you could argue the way he's going about it is all wrong, but but I mean, we don't know that Jordan Lyman is right. I mean, they mentioned that he has like a 25% approval rating or something. I mean, he is really, really unpopular. And for all we know, all this is going to blow up in Lyman's face the minute the movie ends. But, of course, that's not really what it's about. It's about you having respect for the law, having respect for the Constitution, having respect for the office, for, you know, the levers of power that we've constructed. And so that's the ultimate thing. I guess it doesn't really matter whether Lyman is right or not.
That was actually the one bit of science fiction that, you know, strained credulity for me, was the president having that low of an approval number and still getting the Senate and Congress to go along with the treaty.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, you wouldn't be hard. Yeah, right. I mean, nobody would like him at that point if he was that far down.
I was like, who's the Mitch McConnell of this era? That would never happen.
What character actor-wise, I do have to mention the guy. We briefly see the president's physician. And he does this whole thing about your blood pressure is like through the roof. And he's like, you need to take 3 weeks. Here's a great scene where he says, you need to take at least 2 weeks off. And Jordan Lyman says, I'll meet you halfway. I'll take a lap in my pool. Like, that's not really what we're talking about. And the doctor has a great line. He says, I don't know why in this country we elect someone president and then do our best to see if we can kill him. Which I thought was great. And that actor is the same guy from North by Northwest who meets Cary Grant out in the crop dusting field.
Oh,
the same guy. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I love that guy. He just had this crazy career where he went from A movies to Z movies to B movies, just back and forth. He just had a great, probably interesting life in that guy. The last thing I want to mention, this is just sort of a fun fact. This movie was originally supposed to be released in December of 1963, but of course Burt Lancaster thought it would be a bit tough to, you know, offensive, really, considering that the assassination of President Kennedy was still so fresh. So they moved it to February, I think, of 1964. But this movie was never released in Brazil due to the coup d'etat organized by the military of April 1, 1964. The generals who overthrew the government saw the film as uncomfortably close to what they did in real life and did not want Brazilians to be reminded of it, so they banned the film.
Wow.
Life's fun in Brazil, isn't it? You guys don't want to see this movie. Watch Mary Poppins again. It's for the fun for the whole family. You guys will
Eventually they got the Olympics. So, you know, it's fine.
It's all good. So, is there anything else you want to say about it before we wrap up?
No, again, just researching my position at the beginning. I had never seen the movie. I probably never would have seen the movie if you didn't basically just ship it to
me.
It didn't take much. Like, want to be on a podcast? Sure. But I'm glad you did, because I really enjoyed it. And again, like the other thing, like, it did make me uncomfortable at times, you know, thinking about like the idea of this military coup and then watching the news and thinking, oh gosh, there is a faction of the FBI that is actually hostile toward one of the political candidates for a presidential election and actively working against her right now. That's messed up.
You gave it away which one you're talking about by using the her in that sentence.
You know what? I think she's got a bigger pair of balls on her than he does. But anyway, the contemporary parallels notwithstanding, it is a really, really good movie. If you like political dramas, political thrillers, conspiracy movies, or just, you know, classic movies with great writing, great performances, give this one a shot. I'd never seen it. Didn't know anything about it, but I enjoyed the hell out of watching it. So thank you. Thank you for having me on this one to talk about it. This was good. I enjoyed this.
I'm very happy. I love it when I can introduce somebody to a new movie, sort of. And I said, this is one of these movies that even though I've seen it dozens of times at this point, and I have it on as an audio track that I listen to at work. I listen to it a lot. Like, it holds up really well, even though all the surprises are spoiled. And of course, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen the movie, we've already spoiled it all for you. But it shouldn't matter. It is just a good story, well told, with a good healthy dose of, you know, some themes that resonate in the real world. And so I think that makes it a really, really great movie. So absolutely anybody that likes just good political thrillers or just great acting, watching again that scene with Friedrich March and Burt Lancaster squaring off is just too good to be true.
Just see if you can find that scene on YouTube or on online or something, just to watch that scene.
It's so good. It's so, so good. So, and the one last thing I will mention, supposedly in this movie, but then nobody can find him because he's on the cast list, Leonard Nimoy. He's listed in the cast, but no one has ever been able to spot him. So people are wondering if his scene was cut or something, and then they just never took him off the call sheet. But he's in there, so who knows? Maybe he's playing a military guy in the background or something. I didn't see anybody with pointed ears, so I don't know what happened there. So anyway, that's 7 Days of May, a great, great film. I love movies about politics, and this is one of the better ones. And like I said, man, Friedrich March for the win. I want him to be president. I don't know if we can somehow reanimate the corpse of Friedrich March and make him the president. I would vote for that. So anyway, Ryan, again, thank you so much for doing this. This is one of these movies that I was like, I want to talk about it so bad, and nobody I know had seen it. So I thank you for stepping up. I appreciate it.
No problem. Happy to do it.
All right. Where can people find you on the internet?
A number of podcasts, all of them on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. You can also see I'm the writer of a comic strip on Rising Sun Comics called My Pet Ninja, and another one called Red and Green. And the last thing I'll say is just go Cubs.
That's a brave stance to take, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess you mean next year. Right? That's what you're saying. Go Cubs.
There's always next year.
There's always next year. So.
Oh wait, this time it doesn't matter.
Yeah. They're just another team now. Now that they won, they don't have the lovable loser persona. They're good. So, boy, that was a great game. Anyway,
it was.
So if you want to follow the show, of course, we're over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod, and you can find this and all our other episodes on the website, same website as Ryan, findwaterpodcast.com. So thanks everybody for listening, and until next week, that's a wrap.
Abroad in this land in recent months, a whisper
that we have somehow lost our greatness, that we do not have the strength to win without war, the struggles for liberty throughout the world. This is slander, because our country is strong, strong enough to be a peacemaker. It is proud, proud enough to be patient. The whisperers and the detractors, the violent men are wrong. We'll remain strong and proud, peaceful and patient. And we will see a day when on this earth, all men will walk out of the long tunnels of tyranny into the bright sunshine of freedom.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was the president.